Well, can I ask a question?
Sure.
In the beginning of the second part, when you're reading, there was something on assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, it's like, that to me is just how the mind makes assumptions about somebody else's assumptions.
Yes.
And it's just like, you know, and then it's like, well, I'm right, my assumptions, and then I know I'm making assumptions of their assumptions, and it's all from the mind trying to make sense of something. And when I watch that, what it, how it's making sense of something with assumptions, I really don't know. And then it's like, it's in a whirlpool, because it's basing everything to try to make sense of something, or of life, that's based on assumptions that actually are always incomplete.
Welcome to the human existence. Which is exactly why it's so important to actually bring it up as a perspective of reflection, investigation, because you know our what we truly know and know with real discernment is pretty limited, and to be able to relate to the nature of the mind to make associations as a very basic function of the mind. It's that right at the kind of core level. That's perception. Perception is making associations through memory and association. So that's happening, and then we fill in the blanks from there, and so much of it is assumption. So it's important to be holding that with a sense of a certain willingness to investigate, willingness to... it isn't as one's going around in doubt and confusion all the time, but it's sort of like just giving it some space where we're not... It's like Ajahn Chah, it's just not sure, you know, not a sure thing. uncertain. That's the reality of it, and we just make assumptions, we make stories, we lock in those stories, we've got the view of and we've got that position of self that we're protecting, and so, you know, so it hardens along the way and keeps and then of course we end up in disputes and conflict. So it that sense of balance being so important, and willingness to question, willingness to be wrong, which, you know, where that's very threatening, because, you know, we invest in being right so much. But there's tremendous freedom in being wrong. Like, I don't know. Yeah. we tend not to go there. It's just too scary. There's this feeling of false security. Being right, being sure, being certain. It's absolutely this way. This is the way I should be, this is the way they should be, this is the way the world should be. But from a place of Dhamma, then that being able to, I'm assuming a lot, and there's a tremendous freedom in just being, I'm not sure. And which doesn't mean one goes around in just this conflicted sense of doubt and self-doubt, but it's understanding the reality that we base so much of our positions on assumptions. Okay, the next section is the rest of the afternoon. Of course, the overall theme is attachment, but then what do we use as a counterpoint for attachment? What do we use as an antidote? And especially in meditation, but that moves into all the rest of our life very quickly if we allow it. And in the Buddhist teachings, the importance of a word called nekamma, which is renunciation, relinquishment. It's a very important word and concept, letting go, releasing. There's many ways of saying it, but that word, renunciation, is good to put a positive spin on. I think in the English language it has a kind of a scary edge to it, like I'm having to give up something that's going to make me feel bereft and I'm going to miss out on something. But renunciation is something that is much more attuned to, maybe closely tied to simplicity. That ability to just not have to follow every impulse, protect a particular position, stand up for the sense of self, I can relinquish, I can have a sense of renunciation around these things. And I think renunciation is the willingness and ability to renounce that which is, and to relinquish that which is a cause of suffering. And again, that sense of renunciation is. Just the connotations in English language are a certain grim feeling of it. Oh God, renunciation. It's important to reflect how the importance that the Buddha gives to it, and it's like. The Buddha puts nekamma, renunciation, as a barami. It's one of the 10 baramis. It's the third one, so that it comes after generosity and virtue. So those are very beautiful, uplifting qualities, and really, it's a continuation of a theme of a beautiful quality: the ability to put down, set aside, relinquish. And particularly, of course, relinquishing that which tends to lead to suffering. And also that parami are a good translation of parami would be, say, these are for a parami is a force for transformation, like a real wholesome, skillful transformation. So that nekamma is a that renunciation is a opportunity for transformation. So that when we're willing to put down, set aside, relinquish something that complicates the mind, agitates the mind, keeps us suffering, then then it's a blessing. Gives us the opportunity for that real positive transformation. And I think as one of the things is it's important to not view renunciation in terms of again, the sort of idealizing or doctrine, making it sort of a doctrinal position. This is something you should do. You should renounce. You should be letting go. And it's more like understanding the principles of cause and effect, understanding how these causal conditions lead to different outcomes, then one wants to let go of the causal conditions that are leading one to suffering and complication. So it's a and this simple say act of letting go is being able to just letting go, releasing, relinquishing, renouncing. And of course that's brings to mind a well-known saying of Ajahn Chah especially in terms of practice and meditation, but the same thing in one's life. If you let go a little, you get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you get a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll get complete peace. It's very, very easy causal factors. So that recognizing that renunciation isn't about making our minds miserable, it's about greater and more sustainable happiness and well-being. It's what it does. It's by its very nature. So there's a Dhammapada verse, verse 290. It's in, it is wisdom that enables letting go of a lesser happiness in pursuit of a happiness which is greater. So it's you realize, a renunciation is, you're not renouncing your wisdom or your liberation. You're renouncing that which is less satisfying in order to gain that which is more satisfying. So it's a it's an important important distinction, sense of attending to to renunciation. And the it's also important to recognize that, even the Buddha, when he was still, an unawakened bodhisattva, didn't have a his initial reaction to renunciation wasn't that positive. Also, you know, it takes wisdom. There's a the Tapusa Sutta. Which is Anguttara. Sutta 41. And Tapusa goes and meets up with Ananda. In the woods, the great wood. And Tapusa is a householder. And he says to Ananda, Venerable Ananda, sir, we are householders who indulge in sensuality, delight in sensuality, enjoy sensuality, rejoice in sensuality. For us, renunciation seems like a sheer drop-off. Yet I've heard that in this doctrine and discipline, the hearts of the very young monks leap up at renunciation, grow confident, steadfast, and firm, seeing it as peace. So right here is where the doctrine and discipline is contrary to the great mass of people. That is, this issue of renunciation. And so then, Ananda's response is, this calls for talk, householder. Let's go see the Blessed One. Like, I'm not going to deal with this. Let's go see the Buddha. And so then they go and see the Buddha, and of course, Ananda explains what Tapusa, the householder, what his perspective is, and then. And the Buddha's response, so it is, Ananda, so it is. Even I myself, before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, thought, renunciation is good, seclusion is good. And of course, the Buddha left his left the palace and this sort of very keen to be a religious seeker and live simply and all that. And I thought renunciation is good, seclusion is good. But my heart didn't leap up at renunciation, didn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. The thought occurred to me, what is the cause, what is the reason why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation, doesn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace? Then the thought occurred to me, I haven't seen the drawback of sensual pleasures. I haven't pursued that theme. I haven't understood the reward of renunciation. I haven't familiarized myself with it. That's why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation. And so that's a... So then when he says... Then the thought occurred to me, if having seen drawbacks and blah, 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 and understood the reward of renunciation... And if I were to familiarize myself with it, there's the possibility that my heart would leap up at renunciation, grow confident. And so then he does, and then he puts that in this, and it's because of that, when doing that, then that's what understanding or seeing the benefit in renunciation, that was the... kind of a trigger for being able to access deeper states of meditation.
What sutta is that?
It's Anguttara 9, Sutta 41. It's called the Tapusa Sutta. And then he goes through the increasing refinement of attention and letting go, accessing increasingly refined states of samadhi. So, but it comes from renunciation and being. And I say that then, because then it plugs into that the stock phrases of then, I familiarized myself with it. My heart leaped up at renunciation, grew confident, steadfast, firm, seeing it as peace. Then, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. So it's like as a direct result of that, being comfortable in recognizing the benefit of renunciation and reflecting on the drawbacks of sensuality. So that sense of renunciation being a something that arises and one you say relies on that quality of renunciation as a way of encouraging the mind. Step back from the things that are entangling, go forward to those things that are peaceful. Yeah.
Does he delineate the drawbacks of sensuality?
Hey, not in this sutta, but there's some real juicy ones.
Where should I go? Fox News.
Fox News.
Is that a few in opinion?
Is that a few in opinion? Yeah. So the I think one of the I'll take a quick look. But I find the easiest thing so often is just going to access the insight, going into the index and like the subject, and then just going to like the sensuality, and then and usually something really interesting comes up. It's like first one that comes up is, the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta, the great mass of stress. So I'd say, that's probably a good start. So.
Is that Mahima 13?
Yeah, Mahima 13. Yeah, that's Mahima 13. And but that I find so often it's like you get really good start. There's access to insight, boom, sensuality, and then there's a whole list of suttas that are illustrate.
Speak to the relationship of renunciation with, in the West we use the word very often, moderation.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of moderating is, do you see the relationship there?
Or
is renunciation as something more black or white?
Oh, as soon as you start going into practice and it gets less black and white.
That makes me think it's more like moderation, moderating.
Yes, because also when you think in terms of renunciation, it's not that one is renouncing every avenue of pleasure and happiness. It's moderating those habits or tendencies that keep leading one to sort of a frustrating end of experience. Even if it's pleasurable, then one ends up as kind of empty or hollow or frustrated at the end of it. Yeah.
I've been thinking about this thought of just holding things lightly.
Mm-hmm.
In the relationship, and I think he kind of was on the same point.
Yeah, I think that moderation is in that sense of, again, moderation, middle way, but it isn't just because, oh, we'll only get a little bit of pleasure and it'll be okay. Because even a little bit of pleasure of the wrong kind is still unsatisfying. Whereas, say something like, say, renunciation is also should also be tempered with other clusters of wholesome qualities, so that we, by inclining the mind to renunciation and maybe encouraging the mind in, say, sangvega, which is like that sense of spiritual urgency, a sense of real say like a deep motivation that really wants to find a solution, an answer, a way out. So that's a very wholesome and positive quality. Or the quality of pasada, of and pasada is like it's like the root of my name, Pasano, and it has different connotations of clearness, brightness, faith, joy, delight, so that that sense of clarity and brightness in terms of seeing clearly and experiencing a clear heart, clear mind, faith and joy that one nourishes and through seeing and establishing oneself in Dhamma and Dhamma principles, Dhamma practice, nurturing those sources of happiness that really brighten and lift up the mind, lift up the heart. Those are, you don't really want to moderate those. So it's sort of like the and renunciation gives a opens the door into that experience. So yeah, moderation works in some places. Especially in terms, because we, you know, renunciation can sometimes be referring to, you know, certain elements of conduct. So then, okay, we need to really be moderate in some of our conduct, but we're always paying attention to those cause and result, the cause and condition and the result that happens.
And that's tied to discernment.
Yeah, yeah.
So those two are together.
Those two work together. And also, in terms of Dhamma practice, you know, one of the qualities that the Buddha always emphasizes is that yoniso manasikara, that wise attention, skillful reflection. So that is something that modulates and moderates our response to the world around us and to our own impulses. So that inclination to nekamma, renunciation. And again, really trying to hold that nekamma as a parami. Like, well, this is really a force for transformation. So it's incredibly positive, incredibly wholesome. And the Buddha wouldn't make it into a bharami if it didn't have these extremely beneficial results. And so that's something that is important, that aspect of recognizing that renunciation is a it's cultivated in a variety of ways, but oftentimes more like an underlying attitude or how we relate to things, so that we're willing to let go, to let things drop away. That's why the assigned readings for all those people who read them, I know you all did. Bhikkhu Bodhi points to nekamma, renunciation, and compassion being a pair and being like the wings of a bird. So that's what really allows one to fly. So that it seems, you know, logically, somehow logically, or on a rational sort of worldly sense, renunciation and compassion seems to be going in different directions, but they're really, you know, both of them, their common root is the the relationship to suffering. And important to have that say renunciation, you know, coming out of that innate urge to really want to be free from suffering and pain, but then also compassion that is really attuned to wanting to oneself and others to be free from suffering, and so they're mutually supportive. Bhikkhu Bodhi sort of finishes where he wraps up the two quite nicely. Over time, we'll find that the two, though tending in different directions, eventually are mutually reinforcing. Compassion impels us toward greater renunciation, as we see how our own greed and attachment make us a danger to others. And renunciation impels us toward greater compassion, since the relinquishing of craving enables us to exchange the narrow perspectives the narrow perspectives of the ego for the wider perspectives of a mind of boundless sympathy. Held together in this mutually strengthening tension, renunciation and compassion contribute to the wholesome balance of the Buddha's path and to the completeness of its final fruit. Yeah, Rick.
Is we're reflecting on relinquishment, letting go, and it's, I could see when we talk about that, that's a trap even in itself. It's like, oh, I have to relinquish and let go of this, and that can be a trap where it's like, I actually have to relinquish relinquishment. You know, I have to let that go, because that can also be a trap in itself, how the mind can get lost in that.
Yeah, I mean, and especially approaching it from, say, an attachment to view and opinion, like, I have to, I should. If I were a good Buddhist, I'd be a good renunciant as a view. Precept and practice, and sense of, this is what I have to do, I have to, if it just turns into an empty, ideal-driven practice, and it doesn't, still source of suffering, or comes from a sense of self. You know, when I relinquish, I will become a good Buddhist. You know? Maybe not. There's one more suffering being in the world. So it's really understanding, because it should be shining a light on. And that's what we use it for. That's why that use of yoni so manasikara, that wise attention, careful consideration, really seeing, weaving between the ways in which attachments and clinging create suffering, and how we can relinquish and release those, let go of that.
Yeah, I think for me in the practice, talking about compassion, begins that. It kind of begins to offer the space between that for myself. And, watching my mind, and then I feel it in the body, the space, and it starts to let go,
Yeah. Margaret.
Coming to mind for me is the way that we think about how to work with anxiety. So like if a child develops anxiety around separating from a parent, like the more the child doesn't separate, the greater that anxiety becomes, And so then there's sort of the way that you would work with that is with compassion, not to say you rip the child away from the parent, but there is a decisiveness to it. Things like hoarding or anything that's about getting, or pushing away that you're turning into it. So I guess it seems like sometimes it would be about moderation, but sometimes there is sort of a decisiveness. I'm doing this.
And it's okay, bang. This is, and again, that's it. That, in terms of a power of transformation or possibility of transformation, of what a barami, nekama barami, of being able to, really do it, really set the mind and really let go, that has a transformative effect on us, as opposed to kind of doing it in a half-hearted way and then getting half-hearted results. Yes.
Longpo, I was wondering, do you think, would there be a possibility that Parami by Ajahn Susito might come out in book again? I don't know. I thought it was a really great book. I got it here many years ago, and I really enjoyed it. I gave it to a friend, and he kept it, didn't want to give it back. So a group of people would sit together, and we wanted to use that as a book to teach.
Right. I haven't heard any news of it being reprinted. It's a good one to say make a suggestion to the. There's a group of people who are quite committed to printing our books and keeping. Getting new ones out and reprinting some of the old ones. Try to remember that. Because they oftentimes send me an email and do you have any ideas for... So, nah.
I know that Sakula, she has a personal project right now She has a project of trying to raise money to have a certain number of those books republished. So I know that that's...
Well, that's a good start in terms of, because that might be a bit more immediate. That's Portland Friends of the Dhamma.
So popular, they're even selling them on Amazon. They're supposed to not be sold, but they're selling them and sold out. You can't buy them anywhere. So it's that popular.
The website does have it online.
This is true. It is as an ebook or as a Mobi.
There is a huge demand for it.
I know that's sort of from our book person.
They won't mail copies of them to America. You can get them from other monasteries overseas, but they won't mail them here for some reason. I tried to get them.
It's very, very expensive. Maybe when we're in Thailand, we could check and see. Because we're going with, there's a whole bunch of us going. And we'll have extra luggage, yeah. We have to make a list of things that would be good to do.
Is it possible for people that go through that, what do you call it, publish on demand or whatever, you just publish your own, print your own?
Yep.
So that's a possibility too, if you don't want to wait.
But it usually ends up being very expensive just for, say, one copy, but... If you get a group of people together, like Portland Friends of the Dhamma and a few other people, then cuts it immediately. Yeah.
So I understand how compassion can reinforce renunciation, but I have trouble understanding is the reverse. How does renunciation reinforce compassion? Because isn't it possible for renunciation to lead to apathy?
Well, it's certainly possible to make it lead to apathy, but that would be a misapplication of it. It'd be a misapprehension of its purpose, because the Buddha's path is always for the Buddha. Always casts it as a benefit for oneself and a benefit for others. You know, like both together. So it's not anything that undermines effort and. And qualities like compassion, then that would be kind of seen as opposed to the path of practice. Because there isn't really a separation between my suffering and other suffering. So it isn't just about me getting rid of my suffering, then I'm all right. It isn't how the Buddha conceived of the path. It's possible that, you know, with wrong view and wrong practice, that's people do, but that's exactly what they say, that being able to understand attachment and freeing oneself from attachment, how that brings benefit. So that sense, as we pay attention to renunciation, and we start benefiting from relinquishing our own greed, hatred, and delusion, then the result should be a much bigger, clearer heart that's able to encompass others.
What's been coming through my mind all this afternoon is the Metta Sutta, the very last stanza about the wisdom part of it, it's like not attaching to fixed views.
Right.
You know, one isn't born again into this world, and it's interesting, the antidote for attachment. You've gone over both the three phases of the right intention.
Right.
And kind of the middle one, renunciation and compassion, but the kindness is the middle one. It's really interesting.
Yeah, no, and generally sort of that link between loving kindness and compassion is quite very, very strong. It's sort of really linked together. And right intention, sammasankappa. Neya kamma sankappa, that's your initial impulse of right intention, right thought. But then the next are the relinquishing of those thoughts, intentions of ill will and harming, and so then that's the basis for loving kindness and compassion. So that as we are able to relinquish and let go, then those wholesome qualities of both generosity and selflessness, along with loving kindness and compassion, are intrinsic part of the fruit of the practice. So I think contemplating renunciation recognizing it as an antidote to to attachment, but then also paying attention. Like sometimes we sort of start, our mind runs ahead of ourselves, and sort of, oh, I've got to renounce everything to do with the world and blah blah blah, and I just pay attention to the little things. It's that kind of that act of renunciation of that impulse for gratification on a small level. That impulse or gratification of either just have gain, something pleasurable. It doesn't have to be a big thing, but it's sort of, oh, just, can I set that aside? And also reinvestigating, well, what happens when I actually, say, relinquish or renounce the desire? One formulates a desire for some particular kind of food, or desire for some particular kind of possession. What happens when one renounces it? Because the feeling of desire is that I'm not going to be complete if I don't get what I want. And I'm going to miss out on something if I don't get what I want. That's the nature of desire, it's a function of desire. And what happens when we relinquish that desire, when we renounce that desire? We have renunciation toward that desire. Nothing. nothing happens. We just didn't get what we wanted. Everything's the same as before. It isn't how it feels, you know. It's just paying attention to, oh, everything's the same as it was before, except I don't have that desire. I said, oh, okay, that's great. So, just taking note of that, paying attention to that, because it's actually really important. That sense of you know, kind of that. Yeah, that compelling nature of desire. And the same thing with, you know, it's a bit trickier when it comes around to like views and opinions, because so often views and opinions are tied in with our sense of self, who we conceive ourselves to be. And it is helpful to sort of pay attention to that when one does relinquish a particular view, or one challenges a particular view, an opinion that one's holding, that however we've conceived of ourselves, it really hasn't changed. It's just that we have less clutter and in our minds, less hard edges, less boundaries that are quite fixed, and so being able that's the investigation of the benefits and the drawbacks renunciation, around relinquishment, around attachment. What's attachment? Attachment locks us in, slots us into something, and then it's a boundary that we create. I mean, it's a prison that we create for ourselves, and we imprison ourselves in a view, or we imprison ourselves in a particular desire structure, imprison ourselves in a sense of what we should do, what our and who we should be, and that's a tremendous burden. So that casting off that burden is not it's not something to be fearful of or really concerned about. And sort of, this is a great opportunity to set aside. It's like the opportunity to step out of prison. Because, you know, in reality, the doors are open. And we choose to stay, and we choose to sort of make our home there, and that's problematic. Just learning how to realize that this is that investigation of attachment and relinquishment, renunciation, letting go, is an opportunity for really stepping out of the prison that we've created or assumed into existence. So that, you know, there's different ways that we can do that, and you know, part of it is just being willing to put things down, to let things go, because we pick up things without really noticing it. It's like of course, a great example, or the One that's often cited is Ajahn Leam, who's this. He's got probably more duties than all of us combined here, and more things that he takes responsibility for, more duties, more people looking to him, and he carries it all very extremely lightly. Years ago, he was. We were preparing for the Ajahn Chah's cremation ceremonies. We were building this huge new hall because we knew we had a lot of people were coming to Wat Bapong, to Ajahn Chah's monastery, and needed to build this big hall. And he's working on it, and you know, the ceremony is actually coming up, and it's a big royal ceremony as it ended up, and we were expecting that. There's several hundred thousand people showed up, and anyway, he's up working on it, and monks are working on it, lay people are working on it, and his engineer comes along, and he's saying, "Wow, you know, this is a huge hall. Is it? And who designed it?" And then Liam said, "Yeah, I did." And who's overseeing the project? And he said, "Yeah, I am." It's, "Oh, when's it going to be finished?" "Tonight." "Oh, what do you mean tonight? How this is huge. How are you going to get it tonight?" He says, "Yeah." So it comes the evening, it's finished. "Tomorrow morning, I might do it again." Yeah, and that's the, you pick things up in a skillful way, you apply yourself to it, and you put it down. And that's letting go. Letting go isn't sort of, I can't have anything to do with this. You know, it's just, it's like that. So at the beginning of this afternoon, that sense of samadhana, that picking things up rightly. And but it isn't sort of holding on to it either. You pick it up, and you put it down when it's appropriate. It's appropriate, you pick it up again. So that learning, it's that aspect of letting go is it has these nuances that we need to reflect on and experiment with. So maybe this is the whole overarching theme of the day, is meditation. I think we should close with a meditation. So we could maybe sit quietly and just pay attention to attachment and letting go. Because it's, so much of it is how we conceive of it, or how we, it's like, the meditation, we pay attention. It's actually incredibly simple. Just pay attention to one in-breath, and then you pay attention to one out-breath. You don't have to attach to the in-breath. Think, "Oh, I just want in-breaths. Those out-breaths are really terrible." present with awareness and attention. You pick it up, you hold it skillfully, and you let it go. And whether it's the breath whether it's a thought, whether it's a mood, they're picked up and known with awareness, and they're let go with relinquishment and renunciation. And ease and clarity comes from that. So we can just sit quietly. usually. It's kind of a good thing, but maybe we could end with chant the Buddha's words on loving kindness. Good way to end. I don't know what page it's on. 36 or 37 for those. Seven in English, yeah. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state, nor ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay, another Upasika day down. I guess the next big thing that's happening at Abhayagiri is Katina. It's October October 15th for those who are interested to join. It's a large gathering and opportunity for offering, making offerings, offering.